This conference is now being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. To mute and unmute your line during the call, please press star followed by six. Thank you.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening to everyone. Today's our TPB GDP call on Tuesday, the 23rd of February. We have Michele Nylon, Mike O'Connor, Barbara Steele, Paul Diaz, Michael Collins, Barry Cobb, Matt Serlin, James Bladel, Kevin Erdman. From staff, we have Glenda Sangeri, Marika Konings, David Deezer, and myself, Gisela Gruber-White. Boudouin Chambre will be joining us shortly. And if I can please remind everyone to state their names when speaking for transcript purposes. Thank you. Over to you, Michele.
Okay, thank you. Good afternoon, everybody, or good morning for those of you stuck in strange time zones. Before we move on with the main bulk of this, just to give you a quick update, if you recall on the last call, a couple of people threw themselves on swords and agreed to help deal with a couple of policy things we're just going to have a look at to try and draft some stuff together. So that was myself, Mikey, Paul Diaz, and James Bladel. Just to let you know, so far we've been playing a lot of email ping pong, and we've managed to kind of agree on some things, disagree on others, and we're moving forward from that, and we'll report back once we have something substantive. At the moment, we don't have anything substantive, so there's no point in wasting anybody's time with us. Okay, we were looking at the constituency stakeholder group statements. Which number were we up to, Marika? Because my memory is absolutely, is there a number on this?
This is Marika. No, there are no numbers, but we're at issue C, bottom of the page, so page four, bottom, the next comment is from the IPC. I don't want to put Barbara on the spot as she has a bad voice, but maybe it's for something for her to review. Only got a chance to update the sheet today, so we discussed some of the registry comments in the last call. And she might want to have a look and maybe come back with some further comments or feedback on some of the issues we discussed last week.
Right. So we're looking at issue B, is that right, or issue C? Sorry, my brain is a bit fried.
Issue C, bottom of page four.
Right, so the pages actually aren't numbered on the Adobe Connect, which is confusing me, Marika.
Oh, okay. I thought you see on the top the number of pages.
Oh, no, I do. Okay, sorry. Yes. Thank you. Thank you for pointing out that I am really stupid. Marika has realized that I'm stupid. Thank you. Okay, issue C. Whether special provision needs for a change of registrant. Oh, yes. This was one of the things that we were discussing previously. There was a lot of backwards and forwards about what we consider to be a registrant. Which parts of a contact constituted a change of registrant and which parts didn't. Now, to recap, as far as most of the registrars were concerned, it was the bit in who is that's labelled registrant, but the first part of it, whereas other people were concerned about the email address and various other things. Does anybody have any other comments on this?
Well, this is Kevin Erdman. I guess my question is how do you prove the identity or identification? What mechanisms are in place for validating that? If we're going to say there's just one thing in the who is record. Shouldn't there be some other sort of credentials to validate that you're a registrant?
Okay. All right. The other bin, we went through a lot of this, and it was a bit of backwards and forwards. So those of you, if you have a look at the notes that are in there, some of the notes from last week's conversation. Now, there's a commentary from the IPC that we hadn't looked at. Special provisions are needed as part of a system of uniform... God, my eyes aren't working today. Frontline measures that can aid in uncovering potential hijacking attempts. Is anybody from the IPC on this call?
Yes, I am.
Yeah, Kevin Erdman here.
Anil George as well.
Okay, could one of you please clarify what they mean, what is meant by this, or do you have any idea? Guys.
Yeah, this is Anil George. It seemed to me that if we're dealing with the problem of hijacking, the point here was that there should be a system that is applicable to all users so that it can be addressed in an even manner. Given the fact that some victims of hijacking have been able to resolve these issues and others have not.
Okay. Anybody else want to help clarify this? No. Anybody have any other comments on it? Deathly silence. Mikey.
I hate deathly silence.
I know you do. Oh my God! They've all woken up. Okay. Mikey and then James.
I think the main thing is that I agree with that. I think we do need a consistent way to identify and validate. I like the idea of validating the identity of the registrant. And so I would stick my thumbs up on that one. But that's not
what the comment says, though, with all due respect. It said the comment is special provisions are needed as part of a system of uniform frontline measures that can aid in uncovering potential hijacking attempts.
I was actually reacting more to Kevin's commentary.
Okay, fine. You support Kevin, okay. James?
Hi, Michele, this is James, and I just wanted to comment real briefly on the word uniform. I think that it's fairly understood that uniformity and consistency is always a desirable thing. But when it comes to behavior of bad guys, especially serial hijackers, I think that it's good to it's helpful in some respects that registrars have different procedures to identify hijacking. It's helpful that they have different thresholds or tests that they're employing, and it's helpful that even amongst a single registrar, those may change over time because, notoriously, some of these folks are, probing our defenses, so to speak. They are testing which fields can be changed before which flags are thrown up, and so I want to put out to the group the concept that uniformity within a single registrar or across all registrars is not necessarily an automatically desirable trait when we're talking about security issues.
Okay, thank you. Paul Diaz?
Yeah, thanks, Michele. I just want to completely back up what James just said. This proposal, on first blush, may sound like a good idea. Like James said, uniformity is often a good thing, having standards. However, when it comes to security issues, creating a single standard likely will raise significant unintended consequences. And so many times when we've dealt with issues in the transfer working groups, things that we're trying to do for standardization or often convenience and simplicity's sake have very, very significant security ramifications. And exactly as GoDaddy's experience, Network Solutions experiences all the time, there are a significant number of professional hijackers out there that are constantly probing, testing, trying to figure out what we do to protect our registrants because they're very, very clever and they're always looking for the weaknesses. A proposal to create a standard that everybody would stand by would only be making the bad guys' lives a lot easier, and it's not something we could support.
Well, just coming before I let anybody else come here, just a question to James and to Paul. If the uniformity were to refer to the fact that all registrars were expected to adopt a minimum level or a minimum standard of security or to implement their own provisions in this regard without specifying what those provisions were, would that be okay by you?
Michele, this is James. If I could respond to that.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
I'll jump the queue a little bit, so apologies to Anil and Mikey. But, you know, I think that when we start talking about minimum standards, and this is a subject that came up quite frequently in the registration abuse working group, a few things we need to bear in mind is that while the good, you know, the good actor registrars, the folks that attend ICANN meetings and work on these calls, you know, already exceed what would probably constitute a minimum standard or minimum practices. What happens when we start to think about imposing a minimum set of standards, in my opinion, there's a few issues that we need to be cognizant of. One is that, you know, a lot of registrars who are maybe marginal will simply just drop their procedures down to match the minimums and do nothing else. So there's the danger of, you know, least common denominator sort of approach to hijacking. Another issue that I have with the minimum standards is that, and I'm not sure, it looks like David is still on the call, but, you know, when we get into things that are overly prescriptive, so where ICANN has a policy that says, in the situation described by X, registrar will take action Y and Z, that has to be accompanied by a certain level of indemnification on the part of ICANN. And I don't know that ICANN or the registries are willing to indemnify registrars against all types of abuse, but looking at it purely from a registrar perspective, if we're following a mandated recipe and we're not necessarily allowed to improvise on the spot or deviate that, from that, then we need backup from the community if that causes any blowback. So I just wanted to put those out there that this topic came up quite frequently in registration abuse, and now I'm probably going to hear the same story from Mikey, but the other side of that argument that came out of the registration abuse.
Okay, then. Thank you for that. Mikey, then Anil, please.
Well, to save James the pain of listening to the other side of the argument, we did have this argument in registration abuse, and I don't want to repeat the same. We basically got stuck on this one in registration abuse, and so I think we need to figure out a way to get unstuck, because I think we all agree on what we're trying to accomplish, which is how to respond to hijacking attempts. I actually follow the logic that James and Paul have put forward. I get that. And so I'm trying to figure, I guess what I'd like to do is pose the question, if we don't do a set of minimums, and we don't, then what do we do? What we risk if we don't do anything, it seems to me, is leave a gigantic gaping hole through which bad actors can drive their bus, and that's through registrars that aren't at the GoDaddy / Network Solutions, et cetera, Black Knight level of operations. And what do we do about that? We can't just, I don't think it's fair to the community to just leave that hole there unplugged because of that logic. I think we have to get beyond that. That's my puzzler for the day, guys.
Anil, I just wanted to touch on that point. I definitely understand the criticism or comment that you need flexibility in the system and you certainly don't want to race to the bottom. Those are very reasonable points that have been made. My concern is more to Mikey's point, which is if you're talking about a universe of registrars that are incredibly uneven, where not all of the entities are as sophisticated or as conscientious as some of the ones Mikey mentioned, and if we know that there are specific things that contribute to a potential hijacking vulnerability, either a great deal of the time or all of the time, then isn't it sensible to at least identify those and proffer them as part of some type of larger best practices guide that all of these registrars should at least be aware of and should be conscious of acceding to?
Okay, James?
Yeah, real quickly, just wanted to follow up. Mikey and Anil have hit it right on the head, is that we're wrestling with this issue where we have, a thousand, let's say, ICANN accredited registrars, and let's say the top 20 or so are constituting, represent 90% of GTLD registrations. I don't know what the top, where that break point is, but we're talking about, there's some folks on the margins that really aren't, taking their responsibility to security seriously. And how do we close that gap without, hamstringing or handcuffing the folks who are really on the front lines in this on a daily basis? And I think this is just a symptom of that larger conversation. And this is where, from my perspective, I would say we can turn to compliance a little bit. The registrars know who the bad guys are. Patterns develop over time. We know who's easy to work with and who's asleep at the switch. And I think that we could certainly use ICANN's help there as well. I think that the challenge is finding exactly where those folks are in breach or in violation. But I think that patterns establish over time. And I think I may have touched a nerve with David, so I'll drop there.
David, and then Mikey.
Thank you, Michaela. In fact, the contractual compliance team is going to be conducting our first IRTP audit later this calendar year. And as our audit plan comes together, I do want to share that with the working group so that you have the opportunity to see that plan and comment on that plan, quite frankly, before the plan is executed. But I do believe there is a need for minimum standards, and I think the audit will substantiate that. And then it'll be a question of, is ICANN willing to provide some indemnity protection for registrars who, as James pointed out, take some risks here to do the right thing and don't want to, find themselves in breach of their agreement but are willing to take those risks for the benefit of registrants. So I think this is a topic that ought to be addressed through, again, establishment of minimum standards, and we ought to explore what level of indemnity, if any, could be, offered, to registrars to provide protection.
Okay. Mikey?
I think I was going to say pretty much the same thing. I think if we are going to turn to compliance for help, which I think is a fine idea, by the way, James, we need to give some thought to what we are going to measure compliance of. And I think that's where there's got to be some sort of policy / minimum standard set of stuff. And the puzzler about the race to the bottom, I agree, is significant. But I think to wrap this up, my main point is that I think we're all agreeing on what we want to accomplish, and we're stuck on how to get it done. And that if we could get past this getting stuck phase, we would be making a great contribution to the community.
Okay. Thank you. Any other comments on this? Right, next one here from the business constituency. Perhaps this could be addressed by arriving at a consistently applied post-transfer hold policy. And I see Mikey's in the queue. Hold on, Mikey. Down, boy. Wait for a second. Anybody else have any thoughts on this? Okay, Mikey, go ahead.
I was just going to try and translate this because I wrote it, and it's not entirely clear to me, so I imagine it's not terribly helpful for you all either. I think what I was trying to get at in this was the notion that there's a lot of variability right now in the whole policies across registrars post-transfer, and that by making those a little bit more consistent, we might be able to address some of the hijacking issues that are in this issue C. I think that one way to translate this is to say that it's pretty much the same notion that we've just had a big conversation about, but badly phrased.
Okay.
I wouldn't spend a whole lot of time debating it. It's not the best phrase thing I've ever written.
James?
Hi, McKellar. This is James speaking. And my question to Mikey's previous comment is, did you say post-transfer policies at a registrar? Because that's the part I'm struggling with. If I transfer away from a registrar, I'm trying to figure out what that post-transfer practice, why would even be relevant? Or did you mean registries?
No, I think this is Mikey again. I think what I was getting at is, you know, often in hijackings, a domain will skip across several registries in a big hurry. And
registrars,
right? Or registrars. Sorry about that. Thanks, McKaylee. And so I think what I was trying to get at is the notion of slowing that down so that if a hijacking has occurred, it can't skip quite as fast away from the registrant and reduce the number of parties that would be involved in trying to restore it in the case of a dispute. But quite frankly, I can't remember.
To my knowledge, the registry contracts for just about all GTLDs require a 60-day post-transfer hold. So that names have to stay at a registrar, at the new registrar, for 60 days before they can be transferred again. The notable exceptions to this being CommonNet. Am I correct on that, or are we specifically talking about CommonNet here? Or
I think I was.
Or is a 60-day period not long enough?
No. I think that what I was trying to do, and again, I really don't want to defend this. But I think what I was trying to do is get CommonNet up to consistency with the rest, with that 60-day hold.
Barbara, I think you're the best person to answer this, so I'll let you skip ahead of James.
Okay, I apologize for my voice, everyone. Basically, the 60-day hold is actually dictated by the transfer policy itself. Now, it's not a system restriction, but it is a valid reason for a registrar to be able to enact a transfer or deny a transfer.
Poor Barbara.
Sorry, everyone.
Hi, Barbara. Sorry. Okay, so you're saying, what Barbara was saying is that the current policy allows a registrar to reject a transfer within 60 days after a transfer. Sorry, within the first 60 days after a transfer. Is that correct?
I mean, basically what it just says is that, you know, that a transfer cannot occur within 60 days of the initial registration, which I think VeriSign at least, and I suspect that other registry operators have also instituted a systematic restriction on that particular transfer. But then it also stipulates that within 60 days of a transfer from one registrar to another, they cannot issue not connect to it yet another registrar.
Okay.
VeriSign has not instituted a systematic restriction for that particular one. So, you know, the losing registrar does not NAC it, and the gaining registrar has submitted it within 60 days, then it would be allowed to go through after the 5-day grace period.
Anybody have any other comments on that? Okay. Right, moving on to issue D. Whether standards or best practices should be implemented regarding use of registrar lock status, e.g. when it may not, should, or should not be applied. In other words, the registrar lock statuses. Now, the RYS3, that's registry, isn't it? Does anybody know RYS3, is that registries?
Yes, that's the registry.
Okay, thanks.
I've updated the registry and registrars to reflect that it's now stakeholder groups and no longer constituencies.
Stop renaming us, it's confusing, goddammit. Okay, it should be left up to the individual registrars how and when a registrar lock status may, should, or may not or shouldn't be used. Any thoughts on that? That's a comment from the registries. Does anybody agree with that, disagree with that, have any thoughts on that? James agrees with it, Mikey has a comment. Mikey? Barbara agrees with us.
Just jumping ahead to the BC comment, I think this would be a good idea.
Don't jump ahead to the BC comment,
no,
please. Okay, so you said that your comment includes is relevant to this to their comment.
Yeah, I think that basically we've got a disagreement here. We need to hammer on it.
Okay. So you disagree with the registries?
Yeah.
Just so we're clear. Okay. Why?
Well, again, this is back to this sort of variability theme that I seem to beat the drum on all the time, which is that I see no particular business reason, no particular competitive advantage to be found in having different standards for something as arcane and technical as a registrar lock status. I can't imagine a magazine article in Forbes that says, registrar XYZ takes pride in its registrar lock status process. So why can't we get a little consistency into this so that registrants can have a chance of being able to predict how things are going to behave. That's all. Sorry for the frustration.
That's okay. You're allowed. Now we'll disagree with you and tell you why, or not, depending. I'll disagree with you anyway. James, are you going to agree or disagree, or what do you say?
Well, am I becoming that predictable, McKinley, that you're going to go ahead and comment on my, or like some kind of a psychic. I love it. Mikey, I couldn't disagree more. In fact, I was looking for the webpage on our website for some of the products and services that we have built, not solely based upon the use of the registrar lock statuses, but certainly that's a major component of those products and services. In fact, VeriSign has also instituted an RCEP service, and there was a recent article on CircleID about more and more registrars building products and services around that as a security offering. So, this is an area where there's innovation occurring, and there's differentiation occurring as well, where registrars are doing things differently. I see Matt's hand up. I think it was Mark Monitor that actually. Was it Mark Monitor or Matt that wrote the article about why aren't more people using this?
Yep,
it was one of his
yeah,
sidekicks.
So,
yeah.
I mean, it is an important feature that allows registrars to it's part of the ingredients of what we're building to offer to customers to help them manage and control and secure their names.
Now, I'm going to take my hand down temporarily, but I will just say that I agree with James and I disagree with Mikey. Matt, over to you.
Yeah, thanks, Michele. I was just going to pick up on what James said, and it was a colleague of mine that posted the article about the registry lock service that VeriSign has rolled out, and I think and I think Paul had touched on this earlier, but I hear a lot from people about, you know, well, why does the Market Monitor, you know, make more public what our policies are and, you know, what kind of products we have around security. And so when we talk about things like standardizing and all registrars should treat those things the same, I get a little nervous about that, frankly, because I think the fact that we don't publicize what our security is and what our protocols are actually makes us more secure. And so anything that I think levels the playing field and forces every registrar to behave the same really makes me a little nervous, frankly.
Great. Mikey, do you mind if I skip over you for a minute and let the other two guys have a go? I'll come back to you, okay?
Yeah.
Michael Collins?
Yes, I'm going to just have to voice a concern, agreeing with Mikey that I understand the security issue, but there has to be some balance. There has to be some predictability. I happen to be able to remember back before IRTP policy was written and how difficult it was to get some registrars to release a domain name. They would knack it for any reason at all. And I predict if you don't have any standards about policy to unlock a domain name, that it will enable some bad actors to basically lock a domain name up just through creating policies that are too difficult for a registrant to use the unlock. I mean, I can just imagine that all the good things that you guys are talking about are going to be balanced by someone that just doesn't want to lose a domain name and makes it impossible for a registrant to unlock it if we aren't careful and we don't have any standards. Thank you.
Chris Chaplow?
Hi, Chris speaking. I tend to like a sort of clear and orderly world, and I struggle with all these domain locks, and I like the article that you sent me. It was late Sunday night, so I can't remember all of it now. But also, I do remember some months ago, right at the beginning when we were discussing this, asking or sending to the list, can anybody give me a list or email list? Can anybody give me a list of what all these domain lock statuses are, registry lock and all these things? And actually nobody replied, so I don't know whether that meant everybody was asleep or whether there isn't a clear list that, you know, sort of business user can go to the Whois, see the status, and work out exactly where we are with it all. Thank you.
Okay. Mikey, Marika, Paul Diaz. I think that's a reasonable order. Mikey?
I'll wait till the end. You can skip over me again.
Oh, great. I'm going to have great fun. Mikey's given me permission to skip over him, everybody. Marika, then Paul.
Yeah, this is Marika. I just wanted to remind everyone as well, when we had a look at the input that was provided by the ICANN compliance team on the level of complaints received, that the failure to unlock a domain by a registrar was, I think, in the top three. So it is definitely an area where there is confusion or misunderstanding or problems, at least, in addressing those. So that's maybe something to take into account as well as part of this discussion.
Okay. Paul?
Thanks, Michele. To follow on what Marika just said, you know, I'd remind everybody that in the existing IRTP, you know, issue number 7 for the reasons a registrar can deny, it says the domain's already in lock status. The registrar provides a readily accessible and reasonable means for the registrant to remove the lock status. You know, if we have concerns here about quote some registrars. You know, and I question again, you know, here we go again with the outliers that are causing problems and whatnot, then it seems to me that this is an issue ripe for ICANN compliance to look into. And if the data is showing that a very, very significant number of complaints are focused on this, then rather than trying to establish a broad policy that's going to affect everybody when most everybody is not necessarily causing any problems, that ICANN compliance dig in and go after those who are the source of the complaints or the confusion, what have you, and deal with them as necessary.
Okay, thank you. Mikey, do you want to say something now?
Yeah, I I don't have strong disagreements with the arguments that James and Paul and so on have put forward, Matt, etc. But I think we're in the same exact spot that we were in with the last discussion, which is we have to figure out a way to put enough of a framework in place for the compliance team to stand on. If we have nothing, then there's no place to, there's nothing to take to compliance. It may be that what's there is sufficient. We'll have to take a look at that. But I think if we don't build a bridge between the sort of market innovation island and the consistency island, that weaves together a set of tools that compliance can actually effectively use, we're engaging in magical thinking. So I would encourage us to treat this one a lot the way we treated the last one, and it, you know, this is the long string of these. If we could figure out a way to address this kind of issue well, I think we could, again, do a lot of good for the community in general. So I don't want to just roll over and say I'm defeated. I want to try and figure out a way that we can do better, because as I think Tim pointed out a call ago, you know, our reputation as an industry isn't that great, and it's because of these difficulties in resolving the points of view of the various islands that we leave ourselves open to that kind of criticism.
Okay. I've put myself on the queue. I'm just taking my chair hat off for a moment. I'd be very interested in seeing if the complaints that a compliant receive about logs are actually valid complaints, or whether they're due to misunderstandings. Because while it's true that there may be a certain percentage of complaints submitted to complaints in relation to logs, at the moment there's no easy way. And I wouldn't expect compliance to look at the data they have, because it would be impossible. But it would be interesting to see if those, moving forward, if the complaints are actually valid. In other words, are they simply a case of somebody registers a domain name on day one and on day 42 wants to update the name server but thinks that they have to transfer it and can't transfer it because it's within the first days, and therefore this is a massive headache, yada, yada, yada. And they want to skin people alive for no good reason. I mean, is that what's happening, or is it a case of the domain was registered ages and ages and ages ago, and the registrar is not unlocking the domain or being completely unreasonable about it? The other thing, and then I'll let David reply, is I'd be worried as well about all the standard stuff in some respects, because again, if for example it is a registrar's policy to lock all domains,
Michaela? Lost him.
Listen, Rick, I see that Michaela just has been disconnected, so we'll just wait a second for him to dial back in.
I'm glad everyone else talked. I thought it was going to be mine that dropped.
Okay. Looks like I'm getting the high sign from Michaela to say a few words here while he dials back in. And so I'll see if I can fill time by indicating that when we've looked at the complaints here, it really is a combination of both instances. There is genuine misunderstanding on how the policy works, or in short is applied. And then there are legitimate instances where where some registrars have failed to, to institute the lock following the policy. So because of that, we find ourselves in the enforcement world dealing with, these issues kind of in a one-off status. And sometimes it is the squeaky wheel that gets the grease here, and we don't have a very systemic way to address enforcement on this issue. And so complaints that are received by contractual compliance are handled by one or two of my staff members, and we work through them, again, based on the persistence of the complainer at times, and that needs to change. So if there is a better foundational approach, as Mikey suggested, that would help clarify the policy, interpret the application of the policy, and then if compliance has the appropriate tools to continue to enforce the policy, I think there's more work that we could do to address this problem.
Somebody's in the wind making a lot of noise in the call.
It's not me, anyway. Thank you, David. Michael Collins, and then Marika.
Sorry, I was muted. Yes, I had a question for David. David, do you feel that compliance team has the wherewithal to, under current policy, to enforce a reasonable unlocking policy, or could a registrar create a... Sorry. I hope that was
muted. And, you know, made a huge chair squeaking noise just then. Maybe that'll give you a boost to your identity.
If a registrar has a unlock capability, but it's burdensome and difficult, does the policy team, compliance team, have the tools currently to resolve that or not? Thank you.
The short answer is that we are working on that, but we're hopeful that the audit that we're planning will actually, you know, identify with and provide some clarity around the enforcement gaps that exist today, so that we can then attack those gaps through some budgeting requests with resources, as well as with more advanced use of existing software tools, because we are a team of six. And we're spread pretty thin right now, but we're trying to do our best to address, you know, IRTP compliance issues as they arise. But again, it's the squeaky wheel that gets the grease more often than not, and that doesn't help the community, you know, at large. So I think we'll have to take a wait and see approach here, based on the work of this working group and others, and the results of our audit, before I could tell you, you know, that we have everything we need to get the job done.
Marika?
This is Michael. I just want to follow up with Dave on that. If I may go before Marika, I apologize. I wanted to be more specific in my question to David. I specifically mean policy, not other resources. Does the policy that I believe James read to us just a short time ago, is that enforceable in a reasonable way? Thank you.
The short answer is yes. I think it is enforceable, and I do believe that, you know, we could show you some instances where it has been enforced. But again, I think there's still a fair amount of work that hasn't been done, in large part because of the lack of resources and the lack of clarity among registrants who read the policy, or if they don't read it, hear about the policy and then try to interpret it as best they can. Again, based on the actions of, you know, again, outlying registrars who don't have the sophistication or the capabilities that other registrars do to manage this issue, you know, effectively. So I think that's the best answer I can give you at the moment.
Michael, are you okay with that?
Yes, thank you.
Marika?
Yeah, this is Marika. I just recall that someone in the public comments actually suggested or recommended that this debate should be separated between registrar lock status as defined in the protocol, and then the registrar lock status that, you know, I think James is talking about, the specific products that are being developed by registrars and registries, you know, that are a separate area, basically. So maybe that's a path to follow, where the one that's described by the protocol, that there are more clarity is developed around those settings, while you know, the specific development and innovation is left as a separate track. That might be something to consider.
Okay. Anybody else have any thoughts? Oh, Paul Diaz, go ahead.
Thanks, Michele. Just to follow up, Marika, do we have any sense from that public comment? I'm just left wondering, I mean, ultimately what's going to appear in EPP is registrar lock. So, you know, I'm not sure how you parse out the two in terms of protocol versus what a registrar is doing individually behind the scenes. The end result is still going to appear to the public as, quote, registrar lock, correct?
Probably I'm not the right question to ask. Would it get the same status value in Whois if it would be a registrar lock with a special product that's developed or the one that's defined in the protocol? Would it get the same status value? Is it exactly the same?
Yeah, I believe so. If anybody else can answer, please jump in.
No takers? Mikey?
I think that's right, and maybe one way out of this is to consider adding some status values to the pile so that we've got the ability to distinguish various kinds of... We've already got a boatload of locks, so I'm not sure this is the right approach, but I think today... The answer is registrar lock is registrar lock. There is no other
thing. Okay.
I'm happy to check back in the comment to see if there was any further detail. I did look back in our discussion of that comment where we actually said that it would be of interest to get further information on this issue. So maybe something to check in further detail to make sure that we have the right information.
Okay. Anybody else have anything else on this? No? Right. Now, what's the next one there?
Wait, Michele.
Sorry?
Michele, it's Matt.
Hi, Matt. Sorry. Go ahead.
No, so I'm clear. I mean, right now, there in EPP, there is no registrar lock status. That doesn't exist, at least not that displays on the Whois. What's commonly referred to as registrar lock would be client delete prohibited, client transfer prohibited, and client update prohibited. But there is no pure registrar lock status. Or are we talking about changing the protocol so that the longer list of statuses essentially becomes registrar locked or not registrar locked?
No, this is Mikey.
Mikey, go ahead.
I wouldn't go there. I agree with Matt. I know that on previous calls, we've all sort of agreed that the current set of statuses are pretty confusing, but I certainly wouldn't want to collapse those three into one and rename it registrar lock. I think that's bad.
Yeah, no, I'd agree with you. I'm just trying to understand when we talk about registrar lock, what are we ultimately trying to get to? That just the definitions of what constitutes registrar lock? Because every registrar, frankly, might respond differently to that question. I mean, I don't think there is any uniform understanding of what registrar lock is. You know, GoDaddy, I think, uses client renew prohibited, and some registrars I see just use client transfer prohibited. So... If the goal is to get a uniform understanding of exactly which EPP status is equal registrar lock, then I'm all in support of that.
Marika? Oh, what's this? Somebody's put a very large wad of text in the thing. Oh, right.
Yes, this is me. I found the comment and pasted the relevant section where he indeed talks about the status value in the chat.
Yeah.
Okay, that's a great big wad of text.
Sorry.
Do we know? No, it's okay. This issue, who actually worded that? Was that the GNSO, or did that come from somewhere else?
Marika.
Issue D, as the question as such. I think
yes.
It's the transfer working group that basically categorized all the different issues that they had identified and basically, you know, listed those. I think that group came up with that.
So they might have some idea as to what they actually meant by registrar lock.
And maybe it's worth looking back as well at the issues report, because there I try to extract the relevant sections from the different documents that have been developed prior to this working group in dealing with that. And I have to admit, I don't remember by heart exactly what was there, but maybe it's worth checking back there to see if indeed some further details were provided in previous discussions.
Okay. Mikey?
I think Marika's on the right track. I have a feeling that the registrar lock language came when this series of working groups was initially launched, which was so long ago that I think perhaps it precedes EPP. Just been carried forward in our issues list through years and years of these.
Okay. So this is something that's been discussed for a very, very long time, to be polite about it. Right, okay. So maybe we need to have a look at the issues report and come back to it. Okay, guys.
Michaela, just to add, because I think what the person tries to point out, indeed, is the registrar lock term actually came from RRP, which existed before EPP, and that now the correct term would be to speak about the transfer prohibited status. Instead of, and maybe that might clarify our discussion and already separate it from some of the other elements.
Marika, would you mind resending that comment to the list so that we just don't have to go or a link to it or something, so that we can just incorporate it into the notes or something, just so that we capture that somehow.
Okay.
It's just if we could clarify what we're talking about here, it might make things a hell of a lot easier for everybody who uses EPP. I don't even know what RRP? I'm sorry, I'm too young or something. I don't even know what
pre-native
it is.
Pre-native, Michele.
Well, that's what I mean. I'm too young. I wasn't around. It's only the older folks who know what these things are. I think I was teaching people how to wreck the English language at the time. Okay. As it's about 3 minutes to four, and there's no my time, or 3 minutes to the hour, I think we should call it a day. Does anybody have anything else they wish to raise with us at this time? No? Okay. So then we'll all talk again then next week. Okay?
Thanks, Michele.
Righto.
Good, thanks, Michele.
Thank you, Michele.
Bye now.
Thanks, bye. Okay.
Bye now.
Good, bye now.
Thank you, Desiree.